Whatever the topic, I'll try to hold it like this. If in the back you can't hear me, just start waving and I'll know that it's... Let me think. Okay, I get it. All right, so my talk is on log robust portfolio management, and I promise I won't drag you through the full 56 slides. I didn't intend to really go through the all 56 of them anyway, but now that we're actually a little behind schedule, I definitely won't go through all of them. So for those of you who are getting worried, it's all going to be fine. This is joint work with my former student, Ben Kawas, who is now at IBM Research, and my current doctoral student, Elshin Setinkaya, and we're all from Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and thanks to the National Science Foundation for supporting this. So what I'll probably have time to give you a good idea of would be the portfolio management without short sales, so the first half of the talk, and then I'll finish by giving you some insights into how the models and the approaches we've developed change when we incorporate short sales in the modeling. And the motivation for this work when we started investigating this a couple of years ago was to go back to the famous Black and Scholes model, which in its most basic form, very simplified form, just says that the logarithm of the return obeys a normal distribution with some fairly standard notation. And it's widely used in industry, especially for option pricing, because it gives rise to elegant closed-form formulas. On the other hand, even before their model became widely used in the 1970s, other people have looked at the distributions for the logarithm of the stock prices and the stock returns. And there would be Fama, Blatberg, and Gonadis, and a couple of additional people. And it seemed that they agreed that the distribution of the stock prices have fatter tails than what the normal distribution would provide. And in particular, in their 1991 paper, Jansen and DeVries stated that numerous articles have investigated the distribution of share prices and find that the returns are fat-tailed. Nevertheless, there is still controversy about the amount of probability mass in the tails and hence about the most appropriate distribution to use in modeling returns. This controversy has proven hard to resolve. So our idea was that maybe the normal distribution might not be quite the best choice. On the other hand, there was no clear consensus on what would be uniformly better. And all those researchers who have looked at the data at their time, you know, in the 60s, 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, have said that the logarithm of the return were good drivers of uncertainty, so they really wanted to find the distribution of those quantities, the logarithms of the return as opposed to the returns themselves. And on the other hand, keeping in mind that managers want to protect their portfolio against adverse events, we thought, because we're a robust optimizer, right, we thought that robust optimization would be a good candidate to implement in this approach. So we were curious to see what would happen if we tried to incorporate robust optimization elements in this framework. And some people before me have briefly touched upon what robust optimization is, so I'll just give you a very brief overview of it. The idea is to model random variables as uncertain parameters belonging to known intervals or known uncertainty sets. And it's going to optimize the worst case objective. So in the case of maximizing the wealth, you're going to maximize your worst case wealth. So it's inherently a max-mean approach. And the reason why this is going to give good results when implemented in practice and tested in numerical simulations is to use a smart observation to define the uncertainty set to avoid having solutions that will be too conservative. And so the insight is that all independent random variables are generally not going to take the worst case simultaneously. And obviously, this tends to be no more true when you have 1,000 random variables as opposed to when you have 2. So when you have a lot of uncertainty, independent uncertainty, things tend to cancel each other out, so you don't need to consider the worst case for every single possible random variable. You can sort of cut off from the set those really, really bad events you don't think are going to happen. And so the key to the performance of robust optimization is to take the worst case over what we call a reasonable uncertainty set. And that's one thing. And the other thing is that people have liked robust optimization because it's tractable, although on the face of it, if you don't really work in optimization, you know, every day, you could think that Max-Mina proofs are not necessarily that easy to solve, because naively you would think, well, I have a group of variables I'm minimizing over, and I have another one I'm maximizing over, so I can pick a candidate allocation, you know, the thing I want to maximize over, and then for this candidate, minimize my wealth. I found my worst case wealth. Once I have my worst case wealth, so I have minimized, I can shift this back to maximization, try to optimize a little more, find another solution, candidate solution, compute the worst case. So it doesn't seem that it's really that exciting or that tractable or that easy to solve. And the big insight that people have had to make robust optimization something people even wanted to consider doing in practice is that you don't have to solve max-min problems. You can, using strong duality, go back to solving a huge maximization problem, because the inner minimization can be shifted into a max. Okay, and the setting of choice for this to happen is actually to have an objective that is linear in the uncertainty, so that people have looked at robust optimization when they were computing the worst case over the uncertain returns. So that's what people have done before us, and there's many papers on robust optimization, including applied in finance, that are available out there, so I'll just skip them, and you can look at them on the slides later on if you want. And the thing about the people who have looked at robust optimization finance before us is that it's much more common that to model the returns as uncertain variables in the framework, so that it will be linear in the uncertainty and they can apply strong duality and have tractable formulations easily. And we thought that if people are really serious about thinking the logarithm of the return as a true driver of uncertainty, that means specific things about the optimization model that would make the linear model maybe not quite adequate. So we're interested in looking at a different model for robust optimization, which incorporates a lot of non-linearities, and we were hopeful it was going to be a good choice, a good modeling choice. So the contributions, for those of you who are wondering where this all led us, we incorporate randomness under continuously compounded rates of return using range forecast and a budget of uncertainty, which is in line with the Bertie-Meissen-Sim model of robust optimization. We maximize the worst-case portfolio value at the end of the time horizon in a one-period setting, so I will not talk about any rebalancing or anything like that. For the model without short tails, we derived a tractable robust formulation, specifically a linear programming problem with only a moderate increase in the number of constraints and decision variables. So we can still solve very large-scale problems because they remain linear. And for the model with short tails and independent assets, we derived an exact algorithm that involves solving a series of linear problems and a convex problem of one variable. So that was still pretty easy. For the model with short tails and correlated assets, then we ran into more trouble, so we had to study some heuristics. And maybe I'll just give you a hint about why this became so much more complicated. And we also gained a lot of insight into the structure of the optimal allocation and the worst case value of the uncertainty. So I'll just, in the little time I have, give you an idea of what's happening for the case without short tails. And I'll focus at first on independent assets to give you an idea of what's going on. And I have very straightforward notation. N is the number of stock. Capital T is the length of the time horizon in my one period universe. SI0 is initial known value of the stock. W0 is my wealth, and then I have a couple of parameters to characterize the uncertainty. And then XI, what you want to remember, XI are my decision variables, and they represent money. So XI is a fraction of money invested in stock I, or the amount of money invested in stock I. So they're in dollars. So the idea of robust optimization is you look at the description with randomness, and you replace the random variables by uncertain parameters in a given interval. So here, starting with the initial equation I had shown you a couple of minutes ago, we had the Zi at the right was supposed to obey a standard Gaussian distribution in the stochastic model. So what we'll do instead is we're going to model it as a random parameter that is in some interval minus cc. So c is just the half width of my interval. And we'll assume c as given. We've done more work about what happens if we change c and so on, but I won't get into this here, so we'll just take C as given. It has actually very little, not very, but it has little influence on the formulation, because we'll take C the same for all the VI, since they were all supposed to obey the same distribution. Gaussian with mean 0 and standard deviation 1. So for us, we'll look at scale deviation, my Z tilde, that are centered at 0. And because they're scale, their maximum value, maximum absolute value will be 1. So that's a standard reformulation in the robust optimization community, where you go back to uncertain parameters that are scale centered at 0 and with plus or minus 1 as their bounds. The other thing that is important in the robust optimization framework is to have this reasonable uncertainty set I mentioned a few slides ago. And the way we did this here is to use this budget of uncertainty constraint, which bounds the sum of the absolute value of my scale deviation. So we can just do a real quick check to make sure everybody follows what I'm doing. Gamma will be my parameter, my budget of uncertainty. If gamma equals 0, I have a sum of non-negative values that is less than or equal to 0, which means the only possible value that is allowable in my set is to have all my Z tilde, my scale deviation, at 0, so I go back to my nominal model. And if gamma is equal to n, then it doesn't really add anything, since I already knew that my scale deviation were less than or equal to 1. So it's not going to be more constraining. And then taking gamma between 0 and n allows me some flexibility in how much I want to protect my model against uncertainty. This is interestingly the one case I'm aware of where it's much harder to implement the ellipsoidal set approach to robust optimization that Bentola and Mirosky pioneered, as opposed to the linear formulation, so this formulation using L1 norms. So usually it's just a competition between the two, where you have two possible models and you're trying to decide which set actually gives you better results. This, because of nonlinearity in the problem, this is one application I'm aware of where you can't even get into a ellipsoidal set and still have tractable solution. So the problem formulation is going to be about maximizing my worst case wealth. So worst case is computed using the constraint I just introduced. On my constraint on my allocation, so what I want to maximize, will simply be no short sales and my total amount of money invested is equal to W0. So it's not a very it's not very complicated. One point we want to point out right away is that when you look at my objective, I have the sum of, because I say that I don't have short sales, my coefficients from my exponential are non-negative, so I will minimize when I compute my worst case wealth convex function, because it's a sum or a linear combination with positive coefficient of exponential function. This tells you, so here I have a convex function to minimize. This gives you a hint that when I go to short sales, so some coefficient in front of my exponential can be negative, this is going to be much harder. So that just gives you a hint about why this is going to be harder to be with short sales. But for now, we're still having no short sale, and we're happy because we're minimizing a convex function. Even if it's nonlinear, we can still apply strong duality. And when we apply strong duality and do a couple of reformulation, what's interesting about the approach is that although our previous problem, the max min, was nonlinear, we end up with a problem that is actually linear in my decision variable. So my xi now, because I've scaled a couple of things, I've become chi I. So sum of the chi I equal 1, chi I is just my fraction. So that's where my wealth, my allocation is going to be. And I have a couple of auxiliary variables that come from strong duality. So the key, the message of this slide, you know, beyond the pretty notations and pretty math formulas, is that the problem remains linear. And not only that, but we have some insight into the structure of the optimal solution, which is that if you rank your assets in decreasing order of the nominal return, then there is an index J, which we call the diversification index, so that it's optimal to invest in stocks 1 to J, so the J stocks with the highest nominal return, and then in no other stocks beyond that. And you invest amounts that are inversely proportional to the standard deviation of the log return. So it's 1 over sigma I there. You'll notice also that the allocation does not depend on C. So I had told you it doesn't really matter what we want to put on C. It does matter a little bit, of course, because what happens is C is hidden in the choice of J, so the optimal diversification index that the computer will pick. But so that's the only part where it would affect the formulation. An interesting byproduct of this formulation is that even if you don't really want to know what your gamma is, what is the budget of uncertainty, how am I going to decide this, you can just decide if your assets are independent, how many stocks you want to invest in, and then you have directly the optimal allocation you want to implement, since you just have to rank them and invest amount inversely proportional to sigma I. And so that's what this slide was saying. And well, just to show you diversification for an example, gamma and the horizontal axis would be the budget of uncertainty going from 0 to n. We had 50 stock in this example. When gamma equals 0, the nominal model, so I invest only in one stock, the one with the highest nominal return, that's obvious. And then what happens is that gamma increase, my diversification increase, which is something we can prove always happens up until we reach a breakpoint. And so you can imagine this breakpoint where the decision maker just raises arms and just in despair cries out loud that he doesn't really care about being so fancy. If gamma is too high, that means he has a high degree of risk aversion. So at the end, what he just wants to do is to invest everything in the highest worst case return, which makes sense too. So he tries to diversify, and then he decides he gives up, and he's just much happier just putting everything in the safest return. This is a pattern we don't actually see when we have correlation. So we extended the formulation to the case with correlated assets. So it got a little more complicated, but it was still tractable. In particular, we have still a linear formulation. So now we have two groups of constraint over there, and we have the square root of the covariance matrix that appears. But it's still linear, it can still be solved very efficiently. And in our numerical experiments, what we wanted to do when we got started with this was to look at the difference and the potential of our way of implementing robust optimization compared to other people's way of implementing robust optimization. So most of the numerical experiments I have here are just comparison between the traditional robust optimization and this one. And it's actually a nice way to transition from the severe stocks to the numerical result, because you mentioned that robust optimization in practice gives failure diversification, which is something we did see when we compared our approach to traditional robust optimization. Traditional robust optimization is not very diversified, and that's going to be an understatement. But our approach does yield a far greater diversification, and it outperforms the traditional robust approach when performance is measured by percentile values of final portfolio wealth. If the percentile considered is low enough, so you really focus on the left tail of the wealth distribution, or the budget of uncertainty parameters is relatively small. And what this means is that our approach shifts the left tail of the wealth distribution to the right, which is what we want, right, because we want to protect ourselves against adverse events. So it's a good thing that we observed. And this is where I said diversification for the robust optimization in the traditional sense is an understatement, because this and the little red thing, this is what we obtain when we implement robust optimization, the traditional one, to our set of real data. And so this is one, and gamma increase and diversification, there's those three values where it reaches two stocks, then it goes back to one. And our approach, though, shows a pattern we discussed before with an increase in diversification. Now, because the stocks are correlated, you don't see the huge sudden drop anymore. You see a more gradual drop until it reaches a plateau. And this is just a numerical error because we had two stocks that were indistinguishable, but we can actually prove it converged to a really set number of stocks. And the fact that it's seven stocks as opposed to one is due to the correlation between the stocks. So we had some pretty result that shows our approach obliterates the traditional robust approach. So we have relative gains that are pretty significant, I would say. And we also showed using percentile, this is the zero line. So we want to be on top. And the top graph is 5th percentile. So we can see that our approach remains in the positive value. It's a difference between our approach and the traditional robust approach. So as long as we're in the positive number, that means we beat them. And we beat them a lot for the left tail. And then, of course, at some point, you know, it can be. It's not a perfect tool. I wish we could beat them all the time, but it's not very realistic to hope we would. So when people start looking more at less at the left tail, so are less risk averse, the robust optimization tends to give good results too. So the approach we have presented incorporates uncertainty in stock price without requiring the knowledge of the underlying distribution. It builds upon observed dynamics of stock prices while addressing limitation of the log normal model. It leads to tractable linear formulation, and we have characteristics of the structure of the optimal solution without correlation and explained diversification. So that's the part without short sales. I'll give you just one quick graph to finish on with short sales to give you some interest in visiting the slides when they're posted online. If the stocks are independent and you have short sales, you have something like this that happens. So from left to right, you have gamma increasing, so the budget of uncertainty increase at gamma equals zero. This is nominal model, so you just the stocks are ranked in decreasing order of nominal returns. So the number one on top, it would be the stock with the highest nominal return. For the deterministic model, you invest everything in the stock with the highest return, and you short sell the one with the worst. And as your degree of risk aversion to budget of uncertainty increase, you start diversifying more, both in terms of stock you invest in and stock you short sell, until you reach a break point where you just go for the safest solution. And this is a pattern we can prove is always true for correlated for non-correlated stock with short sales, where there will be, when the stocks are ranked in decreasing order of nominal return, you have an index J, so that you invest in all the stock from 1 to J. You have an index L, so that you short sell all the stock from L to N, and then you do nothing with the stock in between. And so, of course, with correlation, so it was more complicated, and I'll leave that for maybe discussions offline so that people get a chance to have a coffee break before the next plenary speaker. So I'll just end here. Just put the conclusions, and I'll just end here.